Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview on this Saturday morning, April 25th. How are we doing this morning? Glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10. And you can also hear us online at 883wppb.org. And each show is archived on my website at annlagori.com and is distributed on podcasts. So there's a lot of ways you can hear the show if you aren't up on Saturday mornings. Also, you can follow me on Facebook. I have a fan page on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter at Ann LaGori, and Instagram at The Ann LaGori. Well, this morning, you will hear a conversation that I had with the CEO of the PGA of America, Seth Waugh. Now, Seth and I spent a lot of time talking about the golf industry in the midst of COVID-19. He gave us suggestions as to how our nation's economy could possibly bounce back during this most challenging time. He talked about how he feels about the new date for the PGA Championship, which was moved from May to April in San Francisco, and if the PGA of America would host a Ryder Cup, which is scheduled for September 25th to the 27th at Whistling Straits in Wisconsin, without spectators. And his answer to that made a lot of news. In fact, USA Today, Golf Week, Golf Magazine, and Golf Digest picked up his response to my question from this interview. And I think you will find some of his answers quite surprising. Now, Seth was the CEO of Deutsche Bank Americas before he took the helm at the PGA of America. And before that, he was the CEO of Quantitative Financial Strategies. And before that, he spent a lot of time at Merrill Lynch. And he has served and still serves on numerous boards of various financial institutions. So needless to say, I trust his judgment and experience on many levels. So I hope you enjoy my interview with Seth Waugh, whose leadership is really made up of nearly 29,000 PGA professionals. It's a huge sports organization. And the organization hosts not only the PGA Championship and the Ryder Cup, but also the Women's PGA Championship and the Senior PGA Championship. And then in the second half of the show, we are going to visit with Michael J. Fiedler, who put together a wonderful book called Working Journal, a photographic and handwritten chronicle focusing on the art of handwriting and storytelling. And I'm honored to be in this book. He came to my house last summer. We sat down. He had me write just a page about myself, and he took photographs. And this book is a collection of all kinds of interesting people who really kind of talk about themselves, but they write about themselves. And I guess so much can be revealed about somebody in their, you know, with in their handwriting. And it's a really kind of fun idea. So Michael J. Fiedler will join me in the second half of the show to talk about his working journal. All right. Great job giving congratulations to Springbrook Country Club in Morristown, New Jersey, because they have been doing so much great charity work, donating truckloads of supplies to a local hospital. And from those efforts, they actually launched a foundation called Clubs Help. And it connects golf and member clubs with local hospitals and activates a powerful network that provides critical resources and support for frontline hospital workers. So you can go to clubshelp.org and see all about what they're doing and how you can help. Fox News interviewed David Bachman, the general manager of Springbrook Country Club. Then it got written up in Morning Read, which is an online golf publication. And it just shows how a great idea that starts small can just gain momentum and do a lot of good. So now clubs all over the country are adopting local hospitals, and individual donors, members from these clubs, companies, they are pitching in to gather, collect, and deliver critical items and resources. Everything from bottled water and sandwiches to paper bags, paper towels, office supplies, vehicles, and actually personnel. So great effort, David, and Springbrook Country Club in Morristown, New Jersey. Really great to see. All right. The match, Champions for Charity. That was announced this past week by Turner Sports. It's going to be sometime in May. And it's going to star Tiger Woods and Peyton Manning playing an exhibition against Phil Mickelson and Tom Brady. And fundraising will benefit COVID-19 relief. So you remember in 2018, over Thanksgiving, Tiger and Phil played the match. And it was really not that interesting. Phil ended up winning on the fourth playoff hole, but the golf was not that riveting, and the banter between the two players, which is really what many fans and myself looked forward to, it really didn't happen. So hopefully by adding Peyton Manning and Tom Brady, they'll make it a lot more fun, and maybe the bantering will be more intense, and maybe some of it will be insightful too between all these superstars. So I look forward to seeing that. It's going to be called the Match Champions for Charity. All right, now the World Golf Hall of Fame honorees for 2021 are complete, and there are four honorees, and obviously, they're all just so worthy. Obviously, Tiger Woods, just incredible what he's accomplished. We all know what he's accomplished. Tim Fincham, he is going to be one of the honorees. PGA Tour commissioner who did so much for the PGA Tour, like almost tripling their prize money. He basically started the first tee program. He created the FedEx Cup in 2007, which is a separate competition at the end of the year, and now pays the winner $15 million. So he did incredible amount. But the two inductees who, to me, are just most fascinating, and I've really enjoyed learning about them, are actually two women. And one of them is Marion Hollins, who was elected into the World Golf Hall of Fame through the contributors category. And the more I read about her, the more fascinated I am. She is one of the great trailblazers in golf. She financed and developed a golf course for women in New York in the 20s, and she was a visionary in golf course architecture. She won the 1921 Women's Amateur. She was the U.S. captain of the first Curtis Cup in 1932, and she really was the visionary behind the incredible Cypress Point Golf Club on the Monterey Peninsula, and helped Alistair McKenzie with Augusta National. So the story goes with Cypress Point is she moved to the West Coast back in the 20s, and she saw a 150-acre site, which she thought would be incredible for Cypress Point, and so she approached Samuel Morse, who organized Pebble Beach, with the idea of a private club, Cypress Point. And the story goes that Seth Rayner thought the carryover, the ocean, on that par 3/16th was going to be too long for most people. And Alistair McKenzie wrote in his book, The Spirit of St. Andrews, that, quote, Miss Hollins said she did not think it was an impossible carry. She then teed up the ball and drove to the middle of the site for the suggested green. And there you have it. That's where the green ended up being. And it was because of her that just infamous par 3/16th is the way it is. I love that story. Sadly, she died at the age of 51 in 1941. But what a trailblazer as a golf architect and as an amateur player as well. And then Susie Maxwell Burning. She's the fourth and final selection, and she was one of six women to capture the U.S. Women's Open at least three times, and the first woman to receive a golf scholarship from Oklahoma City University, competing on the men's golf team. I love that. She was LPGA Tour Rookie of the Year and won her first major at the Women's Western Open in 1965 and won those three U.S. Women's Opens in a six-year span. So I just love reading about these trailblazing women. All right, a couple more stories, and then we'll get to my interview with Seth Waugh. In the NFL, of course, it was a virtual draft, but still entertaining, as NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell hosted from the basement of his house. Joe Burrow, the Heisman Trophy winner from LSU, was the top pick, as expected by the Cincinnati Bengals, who went 2-14 last year. Boy, 60 touchdowns in a senior year at LSU. Burrow led the team to a national title. You can't say enough great things about this kid. I just love watching this guy. Love hearing him talk. Very humble from Southeast Ohio. All right, Ohio State All-America rusher Chase Young. He was the second overall pick by the Washington Redskins. Miami chose quarterback Tua Tagovailoa as the fifth pick, and the Chargers picked quarterback Justin Herbert. And surprisingly, the Green Bay Packers traded up in the draft to take Utah State quarterback Jordan Love as a potential successor to Aaron Rodgers. So people are a little surprised by that, and I'm sure Aaron Rodgers himself had some raised eyebrows concerning that move, but the Packers GM said that they got the best quarterback in the NFL in Aaron Rodgers, and we're going to have him for a while competing for championships. But he went on to say that he thinks it was best for the Packers to get Jordan here and in their system. So the draft continues. Rob Gronkowski, of course, agreeing to come out of retirement to play in Tampa Bay with the one and only Tom Brady. That's going to be huge in Tampa Bay for the Buccaneers. And I just think that's a great story. Gronkowski reuniting with Tom Brady in Tampa. And finally in tennis, Roger Federer, he used a string of tweets this past week to suggest the merger of the governing bodies for the men's and women's professional tennis tours. He said in quotes, "Am I the only one thinking that now is the time for men and women's tennis to be unified and come together as one?" So Billie Jean King was all over that. She loved that idea, and I'm sure it will happen, and maybe now's the time. Both the WTA and the ATP have suspended play until mid-July because of COVID-19. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Come back. You'll hear my interview with the CEO of the PGA of America, Seth Waugh. Sports Interview with Ann LaGoria is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. That's Dune, D-U-N-E, Jewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses, P-E-A-K Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity, change your game. PeakVision.com. Welcome back, and it is my pleasure to welcome Seth Waugh to the show. Seth became the CEO of the PGA of America in September 2018, and the PGA of America is one of the world's largest sports organizations and serves over 29,000 PGA professionals. Hey, Seth, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Jen. Thanks for having me. It's nice to be talking to you again.
First off, how are you and your family doing during this most challenging time?
You know, we're doing great, thanks. I'm a lucky guy. The days are obviously long and grindy as they are for everybody. They're kind of endless. You know, it's Groundhog's Day. They don't seem to have much of a beginning or an end. But we've got five children, and we've got a couple of refugees from New York City that are my goddaughter and a niece. And so every night after I finish up and come out of my cave, it's kind of a party. So it's everybody under the one roof, and obviously this is an awful reason for it. But yeah, you're really grateful for this kind of stolen, unexpected time with family. You know, it's all very simple, and there's no outside influences, and you kind of have big long dinners and movie nights and game nights, and we have odds and evens to see who cleans up every night, and theme nights on Fridays. Tonight's Greek night. So last Friday was Greek night, excuse me. And, so it's really been a real magical, only silver lining to this whole thing. But life is pretty good.
Right. I mean, family time is precious, but crazy, crazy challenging times for sure. And I know you've solved a lot of problems and overcome many roadblocks in your previous life as head of Deutsche Bank Americas. But boy, did you ever imagine something like this?
I don't think anybody did. You know, and as you say, good news, bad news is I've been through a few crises. I kind of lived through 9/11. Where we lost a building that had 4,500 people in it in the tower collapse. And fortunately, we got everybody out before it collapsed. But and you know, dealing with that, and then the financial crisis. And but it's you know, this one is so different in terms of the cure. You know, in those cases, you're trying to build confidence and create activity and sort of you know, create an economy again. And this one, you know, the cure is kind of economic suicide, right? And shutting everything down. You just sort of hope we're not going to kill the, it's obviously what we need to do, and I don't mean it's wrong. It's just you hope you don't kill the patient before you kill the disease. So, and it's, you know, the pain that's being felt kind of everywhere with a shutdown. You know, there's no businesses that ever model their business with zero revenues for, you know, a quarter or two, right? And that's really what we're going through. So I applaud the government. They've done a lot of really, I think, clever and generous kind of things with the SBA loans and the CARES Act. And I think the moves, coordinated moves by the Federal Reserve have been sort of stunning in terms of their size and their breadth and their timing. And so, you know, we're lucky to live in a country where we have the means and the will to kind of get everybody to the other side of this thing. I mean, that's what has to happen, right? We just have to ride it out and hope everybody stays safe and healthy and that we have, you know, an economy on the other side of it. And I think it's all a question of how quickly that happens in terms of, you know, what the recovery looks like. If it takes, you know, 6 to 12 months, I think it's going to be a very deep, long recession. And if it's, you know, three or so months, I think we can have a fairly, you know, quick recovery. Feels like that recovery is going to be in fits and starts, and as it should be, come back slowly and allow, you know, things to open in partial ways and parts of the country open probably faster than others. So, you know, again, I think everybody's kind of doing what they're supposed to do, which is great. It's just, you know, how deep and how long. And I think that's what, you know, this uncertainty is a hard thing for everybody.
Well, I would certainly trust you and your background in finance. I mean, it's obviously well documented and very impressive. You were, as I mentioned, CEO of Deutsche Bank Americas. Before that, CEO of Quantitative Financial Strategies. You spent 11 years at Merrill Lynch. So how would you suggest our country get back economically, Seth? What would your ideas be?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're doing, you know, the government is doing what they need to do. And I think the private sector is also stepping up. It's been, you know, a really, interesting public-private partnership. You know, if you look at what a number of companies are doing to try and sort of cure the PPE issues, and like Fanatics converting their, you know, their factories of T-shirts and hats into medical supplies, and B. Dratty in the golf space has done the same thing. And, you know, so there's, and all the best minds are on it. I think, you know, science is ultimately the fix here, right? We can get through this wave of it, but without some real vaccine at some point, which I'm certainly no expert, but it sounds like best case of that is first quarter of next year, and probably later than that in terms of how clinical trials have to go. But I think you could have a treatment before then. And I think ultimately, you know, I think people are willing to live their lives and take the risk of getting sick. I don't think they're willing to, you know, sort of, or nor should they be, you know, run the risk of dying, right? And so I think, you know, some of the hope from this week has been the, you know, the clinical trials at Gilead and a few other companies that are starting to look like they're going to get on this. I've never seen America not, in the world in this case, not, you know, solve something that's solvable through science once you throw, you know, a wartime effort at it, which is what, you know, is going on here. And so, again, I think that the government is doing what they can. I think it's smart to try and keep people in their jobs. And I think, you know, creating these the cash in people's hands that need it. And I think, you know, a number of the charitable efforts that are already happening, I think that will continue to grow. And those that have can share with those that need. And we all need to share the pain. I set the example the other day that it's as if we're, in a ship at sea and we all need to get to shore. And if we try to throw everybody in the lifeboat at once, we're probably all going to drown. But if we can, kind of be calm and get the weak and the needy and the poor into those boats first and do a number of trips, we'll get everybody to shore. So that's how we thought about it, is how do we get the PGA of America first. It's a perpetual institution put on earth to serve our members, as you say, and grow the game. And I want to hand it off to the next generation in better shape than I found it. And so making sure that survives, making sure our 41 sections around the country also, get through to this other side, most of which are financially stable, but some might need a little bit of help. And then trying to figure out how to reach out to our members and do all we can to, get them there. And we've kind of had a few thoughts on that. One is, first of all, trying to assist on the government programs and making sure everybody understands that in a way that they should, and that, these are first come, first serve kind of programs, and so getting them online to take advantage of what they can take advantage of. This golf is an $85 billion business with almost 2 million people in it, right? So it's not just a game. It's so much more.
Sure.
And it, it's made up of a bunch of small businesses and a bunch of entrepreneurs and independent contractors in the form of our members, the PGA professionals. They rely on obviously commerce and their, the community of golf to kind of make a living. And so we've delayed dues, national dues. We tax-wise cannot cancel them. We would probably this year if we could, but not allowed. Now we've launched a golf emergency relief fund. We've funded that some savings in some of our reserves and have put $5 million in cash into it, as well as $2.5 million, which we're hoping to match in the industry and other donors. And we're out now. We just launched yesterday, in fact, and we're out trying to raise around that and hopefully turn our $7.5 million into quite a bit more than that, right? Sort of golf giving to golf. So it's a golf specific charity. It's relief.golf. If anyone out there wants to check it out, either as a potential beneficiary or perhaps even better as a donor, we'd appreciate it. We hope that it becomes a fund that, is going to aid the entire, the golf industry in a way that, as I said earlier, gets it to the other side. So we're trying to do everything we can think of to be good partners with everybody we're partners with and good stewards of the game and a protector of all things golf, but, certainly our members.
Sure. It's the Golf Emergency Release Fund. You can go to relief.golf. And I know every member of the executive team voluntarily reduced their compensation, Seth. There have been personal donations from members of the board of directors and the other organizing, the PGA Tour, the LPGA Tour, USGA are just some of the industry organizations supporting this. And from what I hear, the site has just been overwhelmed that so many people in the golf business need help.
That's exactly right. We actually had trouble kind of processing everything a little bit yesterday. We've cleaned it all up. The third party, servicer of the collector and distributor of the funds got a bit overwhelmed because of the demand and need. We've slowed it down enough, and everyone. We have kept it open for 24 hours. We have two phases of it, which is the initial phase, which will distribute checks, sort of a short form, quick turnaround, sort of within 2 weeks, $500 to $1,500 cash out of our initial, donation of $5 million. And then we'll start phase two in a week or so, week or two, when phase one wraps up, and we will that is a longer form. It'll sort of look to get to the most in need, and that can raise you can have a grant up to $3,500 there. And so we're again trying to do get cash immediately in people's hands, and then deal with longer term problems as well on a go forward basis. And as you say, we have lots of entities with skin in the game. My whole team volunteered to give up a significant part of their compensation to directly to this. We thought that was the best way to be helpful and again share the pain. But then voluntarily, and very splattered by the fact that our officers and the board all stepped up to do similar donations. And so it's been very heartening. I actually was on CNBC on Friday. They asked me to come on and talk about it. And we've gotten a great response from golfers trying to help golf. I think a number of the tour players and the tour themselves will be very active in here. And, you know, I think it should be the golf charity, hopefully that's, you know, related to COVID, that really reaches the most people. And so, we're proud of what we've tried to do here, and hope that, you know, we can turn it into a whole lot more. So thanks for your kind words.
Sure. We're talking to Seth Waugh, who is the CEO of the PGA of America, and the PGA Championship has been rescheduled from mid-May to August 6th through the 9th, TPC Harding Park in San Francisco. And based on where our country is at the moment, Seth, how confident, say on a scale of 1 to 10, do you think that the PGA Championship will indeed take place in August?
You know, if you said, will it take place in August, I'd be high. I'd be, an 8 or a 9.
Okay.
We think that it's, we want to do it in as normal way, but obviously a safe and a responsible way. That's number one. Obviously that'll be inviolate. We're not going to do anything that puts anybody in danger. But we do think that the summertime, by most experts, say that there should be a kind of a lull, even if we don't have effective treatments at that point. That with social distancing, with everything we're doing now, and with the warmer weather, that there should be a good period there to have more normalcy. We hope that it'll be, with fans. We certainly will plan to do that, but are not only willing but happy to do it without fans. We think, there is a pent-up demand for content and sports that needs to be fed. I think golf, offers a different sort of experience that may allow us to be the first sport back. So probably the PGA Tour announced their new schedule late last week. They're hoping to be playing in middle of June, more or less, with the first four tournaments without fans, and then hoping to add fans after that. So we will have some templates. We've been very coordinated with Jay Monahan and his whole team at the tour on protocols to make it as safe as we possibly can, both with and without fans. We've been in constant contact with the city of San Francisco, and they absolutely want to do this. On the other hand, we're not going to force anything. If that location doesn't feel that it's in the best interest of their city or their state, then we'll have a drop-dead date to try and sort out somewhere else in the country where we perhaps could hold it.
What would the drop dead date be, do you think? As far as holding it in August?
Late spring, early summer, probably. Uh-huh. So we've got a month or two before that really needs to be decided. And we certainly want to do it in San Francisco. We haven't been there in over 25 years and to the West Coast. And we think, particularly from a TV perspective, it'll be prime time in the East Coast. And and primetime viewing kind of around the country. Will be the first major out, which will be a role reversal. We used to be the fourth major until we moved to May last year and became the second one. And so we're happy to try to lead the charge to do it. So I think we have an excellent chance of getting golf in this summer and I think we have a particularly excellent chance of hopefully getting our championship done. And then, have a FedEx Cup for the tour and U.S. Open at Wingfoot in September, and then hopefully our Ryder Cup the week after. And so there will be a lot of pent-up demand, but there'll be a rush of for all of us, golf junkies. There's going to be a lot to watch between July and finishing up with the Masters in November.
It's all going to come down to August, September, October, November. But as you had said earlier, a PGA Championship without fans is still better than no PGA Championship at all. But when you're talking about no spectators, if that's going to be the case, volunteers are there, the staff is there, players, caddies, the media. So are you confident that the PGA of America could pull off a major championship, protecting those who are there if, the general public is not going to go?
The answer is we've got some work to do between now and August, but yes. We've talked to health experts. We're in constant contact with them in a variety of forms. Again, we've been coordinated with the tour. We have estimated that it will be somewhere between 1,000 to 1,500 people that would be needed, from a media perspective, plus, as you say, volunteers, scoring rules, players, caddies. You're still, it's a lot of people, but you're talking about over 200 or 300 acres. You can have a natural distancing. There's no forced contact between anybody. There's ways to not have public indoor spaces, have everything spaced outdoors, put ways to stage have what time people arrive at the course. So, I'm making it up, but let's say the television crew arrives at 7 a.m. And then players start arriving at 8 and officials at 9, and so you don't have crowds waiting gathering. We believe there will be adequate testing at that point and fast testing, such that you could test everybody, say, a week before and a day before, and you could keep people in a relatively controlled space during that week of competition or 4 days of practice round. 2 days of practice round and 4 days of competition. We absolutely believe that it's possible, and as do the health experts that we're talking to. So we believe it's 100% possible, and we just have to make sure that area is not a hot spot or not a scary spot, if you will, at that point in time, right?
Right, right. I know the governor of California had said that the possibility of having mass gatherings in California before September is, quote, unlikely. So, but you say San Francisco is welcoming, yeah. Really wants to host August 6th through 9th. That's not too far away.
Yeah, no, well, it used to seem a long way away, and now it seems awfully close, right? But, I think again, a mass gathering of, could be defined as 200 people in a crowded restaurant, right? But if you talk about 1,000 people over 300 acres, that may not be a mass gathering if you can handle it properly, right? Now, obviously we have to walk them through all the plans. They have to get comfortable with that. We're going to be the best possible partner, but we're going to be, the smartest we can be about how to do it safely and responsible. We're certainly not going to force anything. If California is uncomfortable or the city of San Francisco is uncomfortable, then we're not going to do it. And if we're uncomfortable because, you know, we don't think we can manage it in a way that isn't going to put anybody at risk, then we're not going to do it. And so, but, you know, all intention is to do it, you know, in, because, again, we think it, you know, it's a sort of hopefully a ray of hope for people. It's a distraction. The players certainly want to play. And TV wants to show, and we want to, you know, we want to crown a champion. And so, we're going to do the best we can to pull it off, without, you know, again, by being smart. I've said, you know, having lived through a few of these crises, and they're all different. I mean, the, you know, you have to, I think, do two things. You have to have a, you know, you have to be smart. And more importantly, you have to be human. And if you can kind of think about it that way, you know, how is safety first going to lead the way rather than, you know, profit and loss or any other, you know, sort of measurement. And that's the safety of your own people and your partners and everybody around you. And if you can do that and do it intelligently, then, you know, you've sort of shown the world that you have both a brain, but also a soul. And that's what creates lasting institutions in my mind. And that's how you come out of a crisis, you know, sort of stronger, more united, you know, better aligned with your partners, and better understood, because people are going to watch you and understand kind of who you are by how you, you know, what you do, but as or more importantly, you know, how you behave, right? And that's how we're going to approach everything we do. That's how we ended up with a relief fund, and that's how we're going to approach, you know, our championships. We're going to do them in a way that is the most responsible, the safest, but you know, we're gonna try to have a yes rather than a no if it's possible to do it in given those parameters.
Sure. And would you consider moving the date, even pushing it later in the year if need be?
I think that will end up being very difficult. You know, we worked as an industry very hard to, and the tour and Jay were unbelievable about, you know, accommodating not only his events, but all the trying to have all four majors and a Ryder Cup in, you know, a half a season effectively, or, you know, whatever it'll end up being, two thirds of the season. So, the thought that we could reshuffle again, I think is very hard. And so, I do think at this point things are locked in. If we miss our date, we miss our date. And that's obviously very disappointing, but I don't think you can kind of put Humpty Dumpty back again for another time, right? I'm proud of what we did. I'm proud of, you know, Jay and how he orchestrated a lot of this to, you know, be fair to every golf body. And you know, now it's a bit of, as you say, luck of the draw. If August ends up being a great month and November for some reason doesn't, you know, we'll have gotten lucky and Augusta won't have. And, you know, we all accept that.
Right, right. Well, I can imagine a PGA Championship with no spectators, if that's what it comes down to, Seth, in August. But I can't imagine a Ryder Cup without fans. And would the PGA of America host a Ryder Cup without spectators? I know it's September 25th through the 27th, Kohler, Wisconsin, Whistling Straits. Have you thought about, I'm sure you've thought about it, could they do a Ryder Cup without spectators?
Well, I think, you know, if you've ever been to one, which you probably have, Ann,
sure,
they're pretty unique, right? And they are, you know, the fans are the Ryder Cup to a certain degree. And you're right to ask the question, you know, that moment on the first tee, and, the, you know, it's ironically the first shot on the first day is rather than the final putt on the final day is kind of the moment of the championship, given, you know, how tribal it is and how the fans get into it. And so it is hard to imagine one without fans. You know, we have begun to talk about whether you could create some virtual fan experience, and we're going to try to be as creative as we can. And we'll talk to our partners. Obviously, we have a partner in the European Tour, a great partner in the European Tour. our partners, you know, in every at the PGA Tour and elsewhere, and you know, we'll make the best decision we can about that. But you know, whether to be determined, frankly, whether you know you'd hold it without fans or not. Do you think it is different than you know every other? They're all special, and all of them are obviously you know fan experiences and better with fans. And we're not suggesting that it doesn't change the experience, but in the Ryder Cup, it's particularly important, and so we will be very careful about that. It's a very unique thing. I think if we can pull it off this year, it would be an amazing exclamation point to the year, particularly without the Olympics happening. I think it, and to a certain degree, replaces the Olympics in some ways in terms of you know the international you know sort of patriotism and emotion that comes with the whole thing. And it would be an amazing moment, I think, not only for the game but for you know the whole sports world if we can pull it off with fans. And so that's certainly our hope. That's our plan. And if that gets derailed, we'll you know I'll come back on your show.
Last question, Seth, because I know you're very busy, and I so appreciate your time. How overwhelming has all this been for you? I mean, there's so much fear out there, uncertainty, grief. I would imagine it just has to be so difficult to be a leader of a major organization. Do you have sleepless nights? Is there any kind of fear factor? How are you dealing with it, knowing that you're leading this huge sports organization that affects so many people?
Well, you're nice to ask. The good news and the bad news, again, is that I've lived through a few of them. You know, the two biggest being 9/11, certainly, which was, you know, unimaginable, and then the financial crisis and a few others that felt very serious at the time, but look sort of more minor in retrospect. You know, the sort of the answer is you don't think about it. You're sort of in the middle of something. People are counting on you. You know, get up in the morning and do the best you can, and again have you know a brain and a soul at every decision that you make. You try to be as patient as you can be, as calm as you can be, and as thoughtful as you can be. You know, I try to start the day with, okay, how do we survive? You know, what is my immediate responsibility, and how do I make sure that that I'm doing everything I can within, you know, my job to make sure that, you know, my shareholders or in this case, you know, stakeholders, that I'm satisfying everything I can for them. And then the next part of the day, I kind of think about, okay, how can I help in any way I can to get everybody through this thing? And certainly everybody in our own sphere, but, you know, I've been around for a while, so we're all connecting with different industries and getting calls from, you know, the White House and from, you know, various government officials and industry contacts and outside the industry to kind of share ideas and connect dots for people. And then you start thinking about, okay, well, what's the future? How do we come out of this thing smarter, better? You know, none of us are going to come out of it, you know, financially as intact as we went into it. But you know, you can set yourself up for being that much better for the next, you know, decade. And you know, I think if you think about it in those buckets, there's always, you know, hopefulness. This thing will end. We will come out the other side. There's a question about that. I have total faith in the country to do that, and the world to do that. And as I said earlier, you know, science to figure something out. That's when it's truly over, right? And when we have a vaccine and you know a treatment, that's when it will truly be over, and that will be for a while. But the key is, how do we make sure to get as many people to that point when it's truly over that we possibly can? And we all owe it to our, you know, each other and to, you know, being a good citizen and a good leader to do that in every way we can. I try to call four or five people that I may not have talk to in a while just to see how they're doing, kind of every day. Either
reach
out to some forum and check on them, make sure. And there's, you know, as I started out saying, there's some beauty going on here too, which is to remind us all about what's really important and you know, the simple parts of life and how we've lost that as we've gotten so busy. You know, I said to somebody the other day, it's Little House on the Prairie with internet, right? We're not, you know, we're staying at home. Television barely goes on. We're, you know, we're talking more than we ever have. We've had three meals a day, more or less, with my entire family for, you know, 5 weeks in a row now. That just doesn't happen. And so making sure you take advantage of this time. Maybe there's some long-term goal you had. You're going to get in better shape. You're going to write a book. You're going to learn to play the piano or whatever it is. You know, you're not going to get this time back. And so just writing it off, I think, is a major mistake as well. And I think the right way to get through it is by, you know, helping. And that's going to make you not only, you know, it's not only the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do. And it's going to make you feel better about yourself, right?
Seth, I appreciate your time. Cherish the time that you have with your family. We so appreciate the hope and knowledge and inspiration you provide to the golf industry. I can't thank you enough. Again, the website is relief.golf, the Golf Emergency Relief Fund, and I hope to see you soon.
Thanks for all you do, and good luck to everybody out there. Be smart and stay safe.
Thanks so much. Seth Waugh, the CEO of the PGA of America. Sports Interview with Ann LaGoria is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. That's Dune, D-U-N-E, Jewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses, P-E-A-K Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity, change your game. PeakVision.com. Daft Punk, Kyle. Just trying to wake me up on this Saturday morning. Woo! Gonna start dancing here in the studio any second now. But anyway, welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann LaGoria. Glad you can join us. Where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10. You can hear us from anywhere online at 883wppb.org. And each show turns into a podcast and is archived at annlagoria.com. And joining me this morning, live from Connecticut, Michael J. Fiedler, photographer, photojournalist. The book is called Working Journal, and I'm so delighted to say good morning to you. How are you, Michael?
How's my favorite subject? How are you?
Great to have you on, and it was good to visit with you the other day, Michael. Took the ferry from Connecticut, came to the East End of Long Island. You have a variety of people from the East End in this book.
Yeah, exactly. Working Journal is, for those that don't know, it's a documentary of my fascination of what people do for work. As a photojournalist, I just kind of like to take pictures of people, and a lot of it has to do with also my fascination of handwriting, which is very indicative of people's styles and personality traits. So it's a good combination of both worlds.
Really. Of your passions, and I will get into who's in the book from the East End of Long Island in a second, but started as a naval photojournalist, correct? Aboard the aircraft carrier, the Dwight D. Eisenhower.
That's right, yeah. Well, I was always artistic and just kind of fell into photography when I was in the Navy, and I was on one of the biggest ships that the Navy has. There were 6,000 guys on the ship, and one of my jobs was to take pictures of what people did on the ship. So it kind of set a course for me for being fascinated by what people's occupations are and documenting them in film. So sure, yeah.
And then you had this fascination with pens after your mother gave you a pen. Your mother was a very intense journal writer, correct? She wrote a diary for many, many years?
She did. You know what? And she passed about 3 years ago, but I still have them, and I have all of her diaries, and I remember her writing. And when I went to the Navy, she gave me a little diary, and I got into the habit of writing every day. And it started in, 1987? And fast forward, I haven't missed a day in, 33 years?
Oh, my goodness.
There's 80 volumes of diaries, and it's almost up to 20 million words at this point, if you counted them, so...
Is this a therapeutic exercise? Has it become something that if you don't recount the day in this diary that you feel weird because you do it every day?
Absolutely.
When do you do it at night?
I'm a morning person. I'll have my coffee. My thoughts are fresh. I'll write stuff down. I'll recap things. I'm a big sports fan, so when Tiger won in April, I had to run out and get all the newspaper clippings and paste them into my book and
write it down. Really? So it's more than your writing. You basically are cutting and pasting articles in this. Jeez, it's like a scrapbook.
It's a real fancy scrapbook with a lot of writing in it. So,
are you going to publish this sometime, someday, perhaps?
Yeah. The content is there. Maybe if someone is ever interested in what I had to say, so sure. I mean, it's over a quarter century now of writing, and it came at a very interesting time. I mean, when I started writing, there was no internet, there was no cell phones. It was just, and now we're at the stage where everything has come fast forward, but writing is still a huge element of how I express myself. And maybe someone in the future will be interested in it. I don't know.
Well, this book, Working Journal, just came out, and Diana DeLucia helped you produce it. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. But, as everybody has their own writing style, we all wrote. Now, I don't have great handwriting, I'll tell you that right now. I can read it.
Right.
I can read my writing, thank goodness. But there are some people in this book where, the writing's a little... Some of the writing's beautiful, but some of the people who you have writing, it's very hard to... but everybody has their own style, right?
I can't tell you the amount of people that I interview and have do the writing. They always say, I have the worst handwriting, or, you won't be able to read it. But if you look at the book, you just kind of glean this idea of each person has a tactile way of approaching a blank piece of paper. And the fact is, you don't always have to read every word. I look at handwriting on a blank piece of page as like a canvas, and it's like it's somebody's personal expression through a way of communication that goes through the centuries. I mean, it's not, you're not typing it, you're writing it by hand. It's kind of a lost art, and it's wonderful to see in the book how each person touches the page differently.
You're absolutely right. It is a lost art. I remember I used to take copious notes and, when I was in high school and college and, my notebook and highlight everything. And now, everything's
right,
done.
Right.
Everything's done, on your laptop or on a keyboard,
And or with two thumbs on your phone.
That's exactly, I know. Can you believe it? How far we've digressed, I guess.
Yeah.
in many ways, progress, but many other ways just the opposite.
But what's old is new, and things come back in style. And one of the things that fascinates me about writing is I'm a big fountain pen collector. I go to fountain pen shows, and I'm seeing young people there because they're wanting to find out about this way that they can do handwriting in an artistic way that is it's almost like a novelty to them, just like typewriters are back in style. It goes without saying that records are back in style. Everybody wants to buy vinyl now, so it's kind of a throwback, but people are interested in it nowadays. And I think the book kind of speaks to that because everyone has a chance to write with their own handwriting with the pen on a piece of paper, and I can't tell you the amount of times that after I photograph somebody, they will look at me and say, that was really cool. I haven't done that in a long time. Or it was really interesting to express myself with just a piece of paper and a pen, because people don't take the time to do that nowadays. And the book kind of celebrates that.
I still have my dad's classic typewriter in my office. I just love that. I mean, I don't know, you know, how it was just, you know, back then, you know, it took so much time, because if you made a mistake, you had to go back and, you know, and correct it with, I don't know, one of the...
Well, the whiteout.
The whiteout, or even before whiteout. What did they do before whiteout? They had those little strips, right?
Yeah, and you have to put it in the typewriter and then go back. Yeah, I mean, how did we even complete a document back then? It's crazy.
But they're works of art, these typewriters, you know, these just classic typewriters. And they make such cool artistic pieces, too, just to look at. But so tell us the process. You know, I'll use, you know, when you came to my house as an example, we sat down. First of all, we had you're very personable, so it's so easy to get to know you and feel comfortable with you, right? And then just talk about the process, about how, you know, you gave me the questions, and then I wrote on, you had this nice little pad that I wrote on, and then you took the picture. You're a photo, you're a portrait photographer, so we you know, we set that up. Talk about the process of doing the book.
Well, you know, the whole process, like we've talked about, it stems from my fascination with handwriting, but also photography. But some of your listeners may remember the name Studs Terkel. He was a famous author from Chicago. He wrote a book in 1974 called Working. And basically, it was an anthology of the different jobs that people do. And these were the types of people that I would meet at the newspapers that I was working at as a daily newspaper photographer. The mayor, a baseball coach, police officer, a nurse, a pharmacist, a fishmonger, a security guard. And I just thought their stories were fascinating, and I just wanted to let them tell their own story. So what the book is all about is me spending a couple of hours with somebody, like yourself, Anne, who's a sports radio talk show host. And I'm wondering, what's it like to do that? In fact, that could have been the name for the book. It like to do that?
Exactly. That's your sequel.
Right. Yeah, it could be the sequel. So, as you know, to your question, I'm at your house. I'm looking at all your sports stuff. I'm fascinated about, you know, how you have met all these people, these sports figures, the interviews that you've done, the process of your work, and taking a portrait of you in your studio when you're doing a sports program, and then having you write about it. That's my vibe. I mean, that to me is a wonderful way to process the things that make the world meaningful to me.
You came to the house a couple of days ago. You met my mom, Cecilia. Give mom a shout out, because she's listening as we speak.
Hey, mom, fantastic. Hey there, how are you? I know you're listening. And yeah, it was great meeting her. You guys are great together.
Cecilia,
fantastic.
She's my inspiration, my champion. So you came to town. You went to Shelter Island, and Marie Eiffel, who owns a restaurant on Shelter Island, is actually the first chapter in your book. Talk a little bit about Marie, because she has an incredible story.
Marie is fantastic. She's from Paris. She is an amazing cook. She knows food. If you get the book, you can read a little bit about the hardships that she overcame. She was in a car accident. She overcame a lot. I mean, she really almost passed away. And she just rebuilt herself. She came to Shelter Island, and she's an institution there now. She has this amazing restaurant. And if you see her picture in the book, there's a vibrancy about her. And just spending a couple of hours with her in her kitchen and letting her tell her story, a wonderful experience. So
your photograph of her is incredible. I mean, I don't know her, but I feel like I know her just by looking at this gorgeous picture of this woman. And as you say,
so
vibrant,
expressive,
and just full of love. You can see that. And she said when she went through her very serious car accident, she said she saw the light and obviously just totally changed her. And she's this big success story. And I have to go. I go to Shelter Island frequently, so I'm gonna next time I go to Shelter Island, I'm going to say hello.
She's a great lady. The food at her place is amazing, and my book is for sale at her place, and she's on the cover, and she'll probably sign it for you if you buy one.
Oh, so, I love that.
Yeah, Marie is great. She's top notch. Great
so
lady.
You got Marie. You got a shoe shiner. You got an airline captain, a woman for Southwest Airlines. You got a beekeeper. Talk about John Carson, who's the beekeeper. He takes care of bees at Sabonic Golf Club. How fascinating is that?
Yeah. Well, I know you mentioned Diana DeLucia. She's my producer, and she's very involved with her own project, Golf Kitchen, where she tells the stories and does recipes and highlights the chefs from the great restaurants. And we were out in Long Island, and it turns out that Sabonic has their own beekeeper. So, I mean, it was a perfect tie-in. His name is John Carson, and it was just fascinating spending a couple of hours with this guy. I know more about bees than I ever would have known if I hadn't have met him. And we were out there, and the bees are making honey, and he's telling me the whole story. And it's a very interesting job. You really have to know what you're doing. And one thing about John is he is so passionate about it. He absolutely loves what he does, and I felt it was really important to include him in the book because it's all about what people do for jobs and what they love to do. And John, man, he is a character, and I was glad that we were able to capture him at Sabonic.
And what an interesting photograph you have of him. Obviously, he has his mask on. He's holding this whole tray of bees. Where were you standing when you took this picture? Did you have to have protection?
I thought I did, but he didn't show up with any. So the intrepid photographer that I am, I was like, well, I'm going to do whatever I have to do to make the picture. So it was kind of funny. I'm standing there, and Diana was with me. And I don't even know what they call that canister that the smoke comes out. So she's pumping the handle on this thing to make the smoke come out. And the bees are flying around. And John is looking at the bees. And it all came together. It
was unbelievable. You really capture what this guy is doing. And he has said in his story that he believes humans draw in energy from nature. It's food for the soul. And, boy, you really capture these people in these portrait photographs and then in their own, obviously, handwriting. You also went to Montauk and talked to Chris O'Brien, a fisherman.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting because you were going to ask me how I meet people. Sometimes I meet them because I'm introduced to them. Sometimes I meet them because, like the guy that worked on the side of the highway, I drove past and I saw him and I wanted to do that photograph, or sometimes it's formal introductions.
You just stopped on the side of the highway to talk to this guy.
They're paving the highways in Connecticut, and you know it's at night. I know that it would be a good picture, so the highway department was flabbergasted of why I would want to take pictures on the side of the highway at night. But if you look at the photographs in the book, it all came together pretty well. But Chris O'Brien, we just showed up, and Diana was with me, and we just started hanging out at the bars after the guys came back from the day of fishing. I mean, they thought we were nuts. We obviously didn't belong there. Diana, she's from Australia. She's very pretty. She's like 6 feet tall, and I showed up, and you could tell I wasn't a fisherman, so they're very suspicious of who we were.
I would think. Diana is gorgeous, by the way. So they were thinking,
really
what is going on here?
Anytime I start this project and talk to people, they think I'm a salesman. They think I'm trying to sell them something because, I mean, I kind of maybe come off that way. But once they get the idea, so we sat down with Chris and I said, look, this is the book we're doing. I think it would be really cool to photograph a fisherman from, you know, Long Island. He had a great look. If you see his book in the picture, he looks like a young Hemingway. I mean, he's got this beard, and he's on the boat, and there's nets and stuff like that. So, once he got it, and once they figured out what we were doing, we got the go-ahead, and it was great to go on the boat with him.
Did you do it that day, or did you schedule it and go back to do it?
No, no, we met him that afternoon. We had a few beers, hung out, and I said, I will be back tomorrow because they start early. So I was, you know, up at 5 o'clock to go, you know, meet with Chris again, and the picture worked out great. But it's like, I got to tell you, Ann, it's like going on a field trip every day. There was a you probably know this guy, George Plimpton. The writer,
sure.
He used to like immerse himself.
Right, participatory journalist.
Exactly. I think didn't he try to be a hockey goalie one time and
absolutely.
He wrote a book about it?
Just a brilliant journalist, and I loved
his
whole concept.
The Bogeyman, I think he wrote, because he was, you know, trying to become a better golfer, and he wrote a book about it. That's kind of what I do, but in little short spurts.
But so, what's interesting is when Diana interviewed you in this book, an interview with Michael J. Fiedler, it's typed. You didn't write it.
Well,
what's that all about?
I could have written it, and I do introduce each person with my own handwriting. So my handwriting is in the book a little bit. But, yeah, that was a little bit more of a standard approach with Diana's interview. So, yeah.
And you have this fascination with these classic pens. Can you write, and you have them photographed here beautifully. Talk a little bit about that interest.
You know, like I said, I've been writing for a long time. I tried my first fountain pen a number of years ago, and I just got hooked, and I didn't realize then the amount of variety of pens there are, the different styles. They really are like artwork. You wouldn't know it from looking at me, but I'm a huge nerd. I'm like the biggest nerd you've ever met. I go to fountain pen shows. The only thing I don't have is the tweed coat. I mean, I don't do that.
Oh, my God. You're too funny, Michael.
I love pens.
You love pens. You like writing. This book is perfect for you. Who most surprised you of all the people in the book? Who was maybe the big shocker? Somebody that, you know, revealed himself or herself to you that figured.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite subjects in the book is Pastor Ashley Johnson. I photographed him in Hartford, in the north end of Hartford. I spent more time at church that one day trying to get a good picture of him than I've been in years. But he had some of the most interesting things to say. He was really connected with his community. And if the experience that I had with him went beyond just, you know, hanging out and taking his picture. He had a wonderful message, and I loved taking his picture, and just a great guy. And sometimes you just have really good experiences with quality people. And if you get the book and you read Ashley's, Pastor Johnson's segment, he's just a terrific guy.
Well, listen, this has been such a great project. I'm so glad I'm a part of it. All the best with it. How do people order the Working Journal?
A Working Journal has its own website. You can go to working-journal.com, and the book is available there. And anybody that purchases it will get it signed with a very fancy fountain pen by yours truly.
And, you know, we didn't mention Marty Hackle is in it from the golf world.
Oh my God,
Mr.
Marty.
Fashion, he's
Love
in it.
Marty.
You have a couple people from the golf world in it, which is great.
I do. Bradley Klein, who is a famous golf writer, golf architect guy. So, yeah, there's some golf people in there. There's some sports people in there. If you like food, Jacques Pepin, the original rock star chef, he is in there. So, some cool people and their own expressions of what they do with their handwriting. So it's a pretty good package.
Working-journal.com. Michael J. Fiedler, all the best with it. Can't wait till you come visit us again here on the east end of Long Island.
Ann, thank you so much. Have an awesome day and good luck at the game.
My thanks to the CEO of the PGA of America, Seth Waugh, to Michael J. Fiedler, author of Working Journal, and to our studio engineer, Kyle Lynch. Have a great week, everybody. Stay safe. Stay positive. I'll talk to you next Saturday morning right here on Sports Interview with Ann LaGorrie.